Welcome back, everyone, to Millwood and Micah, A Star Wars Story. My name is Amanda Millwood, and I'm a screenwriter, actor, director, and a huge fan of Star Wars.
And my name's Todd Micah. I'm the author of the Grimguard book series, and we have never watched all the Star Wars movies in order with anyone until now.
Until now.
If you've been following along with our podcast, then you know that Amanda and I have been watching through all the Star Wars movies, and today we are picking up on part two of our review and analysis of Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope. Now, last time we went into some hot takes on the movie. We talked a little bit about it being, of course, a classic piece of cinema. Without doubt, one of the, if not debatably, the most influential film of all time. And, you know, while we were talking about a lot of different characters, we talked about Princess Leia, we talked about Han Solo, we definitely talked a little bit about Luke, but I think only in the "wow, is this kid whiny" sense.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of his defining trait, I feel like, in this movie, to be
right.
Fair.
It's his primary character. He just downloaded whiny into his personality.
Yes.
But, you know, one of the things that I actually picked up on with Luke, and Luke has a very, very obvious character arc that he carries through in this movie. Sure, he's whiny kid the entire time, but you know, Luke Skywalker is a great model, one of the clearest models, I would say, of the storyline of the classic hero's journey. The hero's journey that is replicated time and time again, as explained in the classic Joseph Campbell book, Hero with a Thousand Faces, the story of the hero who's living his everyday life. He is sort of the everyman, whether he truly is an everyman or whether he is in fact some special person and doesn't realize it. And his everyday boring existence is interrupted by the larger struggle. Think about this. It's the droids showing up in Star Wars with the plans to the Death Star and the secret message from Princess Leia. It's Harry Potter getting the letter inviting him to Hogwarts. It's Gandalf showing up for Bilbo's birthday and Frodo winds up with the ring. And all of them start out to some degree with some obstacle, usually what they call refusing the call. It is the call to adventure that comes knocking on your door, threatening to whisk you away out of your boring everyday life and carry you away off into whatever it is that is happening in the bigger, larger world, the conflict between good and evil that your little life is unbothered by.
So, real quick, I want you to keep going, but I did want to interject while you're on here real quick, because like watching this movie, he does go on the hero's journey, like Luke does. Except for one, well, okay. Sorry. So for his character arc, I don't really think he has much of one in this movie. And I know that that might be controversial, but just from a character perspective, like, yes, his situation and environment changes for sure. You know, he starts as a young farm boy and ends as the hero of the rebellion. But he's always wanted that. You know what I mean? Like, he has always, it's not like he does, in a way, refuse the call initially from Obi-Wan because he's got chores to do. I have math homework. I can't go out. Like, that is literally what happened.
Yeah.
But the second that his quote-unquote obstacle of, you know, his aunt and uncle and the farm being raided and all that happens, he's like, okay, cool, let's go. Like, I'm ready. Let's do this. Like, you know, without a second thought. Like, so.
Here's the thing. I feel like Luke, in that sense, he has a little bit more of a humanly relatable sense of agency to him. Because, like, one of the examples that's very close to him is Frodo in The Lord of the Rings. But Frodo doesn't voluntarily take the ring. It's just kind of forced on him. You have the responsibility. You're the ring bearer. The ring has, like, chosen you, basically. Look, you can hold it and you're not tempted by it. Guess you've got to do it. And Frodo doesn't want it. Over and over again, he doesn't want it. He's doing this not of his own agency. Now, while that doesn't make Frodo a bad character in the sense of the hero's journey, he still follows through with a lot of the growths and archetypes, and he overcomes the challenges. But like, Frodo doesn't really have any agency in bringing the ring all the way to the very end. He doesn't want it. Luke Skywalker, in a way, is a better and more relatable model because he wants to, like you said, he's excited when he hears C-3PO mention the rebellion against the Empire. He has a drive to leave and go join the Imperial Academy and become a pilot and make something of himself. And who knows, maybe he would have joined the rebellion anyway. But he has that same tie that we have that's so relatable to us, which is we want to break away. And even when we're handed the golden opportunity to do so, even when the keys to the car are being given to us, we're like, but maybe I shouldn't. Maybe my parents will be disappointed. Maybe people will be disappointed in me. Maybe I am shirking my responsibilities. He has a more relatable struggle where he in himself holds himself back. I kind of think that's what makes Luke a better and one of the best depictions of that. And that's why I say he's kind of the quintessential demonstration of this part of the hero's journey.
Interesting. Never really thought about it like that, but yeah, it's true.
Yeah, because it's very unrealistic for someone to be like, hey, here's the keys to the bigger world. And you're like, I don't want them. They're like, nope, you have to do it. We're pushing you out the door because the ringwraiths are going to come and kill everyone if you don't. You're like, oh, okay, sure, I guess. Bye. I'm going on an adventure, a really, really, really unexpected and unwanted adventure.
Yes.
But, you know, something else about Luke Skywalker that dawned on me only on this time, and I've seen this movie many, many, many times in my life. We would watch this every New Year's, every Christmas growing up. Like, this movie was just on every time there was a Star Wars movie marathon when I was a kid. This was it. Because it started late at night, like, this was the only one I saw because, like, Return of the Jedi would be on at, like, midnight and my dad would be up watching it. But, like, I'd always see this movie. But one thing that dawned on me this viewing that never dawned on me before is that two times by two different people and immediately following crushing losses to Luke, he is told, quote, there's nothing you could have done. When he goes and the homestead is burning, which this whole movie, as we said, is very lighthearted. And I kind of thought to myself, oh, maybe there isn't a part in this movie where I cry. I don't think there's no big heavy drama like we talked about in the last episode. But boy, when I see Luke Skywalker run home, well, drive home, but you know what I mean, rush home and find Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru absolutely horrifyingly killed outside of his burning home, there is something very visceral about that scene of like, coming home and your home is just gone. It is just is actively burning and your loved ones are just dead in front of you. They're like pretty dead, like face up into the camera. Dead. They are like you barely recognizable as human beings dead. Horrifying, horrifying, traumatic. Yeah. I realized
really well.
Like, yeah.
To be fair, he took it really well.
He took it pretty good. Yeah, he took it standing up. He really did. And it really gets me. And I think one of the things that does get me, and maybe this is a personal thing for me, is how Luke Skywalker does take it standing up. And where many characters, and this is where I say that, like, this is a character growth development. This kid's been whining the entire time. I gotta go to Sashi Station for power converters. All my friends are gone. The droids are stolen. Like, you know, he's such a whiner. But when his aunt and uncle are murdered in front of him, like, his voice drops an octave. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He takes it standing up and he watches. He has that moment where he like looks away and it looks like defeat, but then he like looks fully into it. Mm-hmm. He could have turned away and is like, no, this is horrifying. This is a terrible memory. I'm going to do my best to forget this. I'm going to turn away and run away. And he doesn't. He turns his face back in what I think is the most profound moment of the movie, really, truly, where he is standing there, not turned away from his problems, not crumpled up on the ground, weeping into his hands. He is standing there, not a tear shed, staring into what the Empire has done and allowing it to change him and motivate him and put something into him, a willingness to fight and a willingness to kill, because that's exactly what he does in these moments where things are taken from him, almost like someone else with a Skywalker
who
name. Right. It's very much like that moment, although not exactly the same, where Anakin's head is bowed over his dead mother, and then he looks up and he has a different look in his eye, because that was your favorite mm-hmm. moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a really good scene and very, effective for really pushing the character and the story forward in a huge way. And yeah, I do think that that is some really good acting from Mark Hamill. Kind of like Hayden Christensen, I was going to say before him, not before him.
Like his father before.
I
am an actor like my father before me.
Yes. I think that Mark Hamill does a lot in those moments, in those quieter moments when he's not talking and he's not having to say Lucas dialogue with his eyes and his face. Because I think he is a really good facial and eye actor, just like Hayden Christensen is. So again, they are very similar in that way.
Yeah.
And again, there's no dialogue in that moment. He's just, as you say, looks away and then looks back.
Yeah.
And you can kind of just see the gears starting to turn in his head of like, okay, fuck the Empire. They're dead to me. I'm going to do whatever I can to get back at them. And like, you know, just really getting that, like I said, that motivation to move the story and the character forward.
Right.
It's a really good scene.
Yeah. And see, with Luke Skywalker then moving forward, when he returns back to Obi-Wan, the very first thing he says to him is, there's nothing you could have done, Luke. If you were there, you would have been killed too. And the droids would now be in the hands of the Empire. And the consolation he's given is there's nothing you could have done. He is told that in that situation, when faced with this threat, he would have been powerless and that his presence mm-hmm. there would have just made things worse. Later, when Obi-Wan is killed in front of his eyes and he's called into the ship and they leave and the Millennium Falcon turns and they flee the Death Star, Princess Leia comes over to him and Leia puts his poncho over his shoulders like a blanket to console him, and she puts her arm around him and she says, there's nothing you could have done, Luke. And that is such a consoling thing, but it's what you say to somebody who's a child.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say that to an adult, you say it to a child. It's that, oh, well, this was bigger than you. You don't blame yourself, like those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it's a deeply unempowering consolation. It's your aunt and uncle died. There's nothing you could have done. Your mentor mm-hmm. died. There's nothing you could have done. And so a big part of Luke's character arc, I realize, is that at the end of the movie, what happens that's transformative for Luke is that the burden of destroying the Death Star winds up falling on him. And I love that moment where he like calls Biggs and Wedge and he's like, all right, guys, we're going in full throttle. And you see him take charge as unspoken inside him. It's as if now there is something I can do. The Empire killed my family. There was nothing I could do. The Empire killed my mentor, and there was nothing I could do. But the Empire is about to kill all my friends, and there is something I can do.
Yeah,
and the answer he's given is to use the Force. It's exactly it. The empowering message within Star Wars, because I've said before, the Force is nothing more but the power of belief. It is faith. It is the belief that something could happen, and believing in yourself is the moral of the story that Luke Skywalker brings forward to us. If you believe in yourself, you can make it happen. There is something you can do.
Mm-hmm. If you just convert to Christianity.
No. To the Jedi
Jesus
religion.
Into your life. Yes. Space Jesus. No, you're absolutely right.
This, I think, also is, we will revisit this very point in The Last Jedi.
Oh, yes. Get there. Oh, space Jesus is a running theme. No. Just like, not really so much about his character arc, but just since we were talking about Luke, my favorite outfit of the movie is actually Luke's Tatooine outfit. I love the fit. Like, I love that he's got these incredibly skinny jeans and then this just like three times too big size shirt. Just like,
dude,
I love
that. It looks so comfy.
It does. It looks like such a comfy outfit. And I love the boots and the wraps around his legs and like the cool loose belt that he's got with all the gadgets and bat belt. And I don't know. It's just, it's like, to me, when I think Luke Skywalker, this is the Luke that I picture. Like, visually, I picture him with his Tatooine outfit and, you know, just the sort of wide-eyed, youthful look about him, with, you know, the what is it called? The Beatles haircut.
The mullet.
Yes. You know, I don't think personally, except for maybe The Last Jedi, I don't think Mark Hamill has ever looked better than he did in this movie, especially in that particular outfit.
Yeah.
You know, he really did capture the youthful innocence of Luke, I think, perfectly. And I think that in The Last Jedi, he captures the gruff, you know, serious, traumatized Luke very well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do love the outfit, and I love that it's all white, how it symbolizes that he is the true hero of the story. And,
right.
You know, he kind of mirrors Princess Leia, who's also in all white, which, again, not intentional at all. But it is a nice mirror and kind of a foreshadowing for them being, you know, twins and all that.
Yeah. It's really funny, and, by the way, because I don't know how familiar you are with this. Following Star Wars, Marvel Comics was given license to make a whole bunch of Star Wars comics that depicted the further ventures of Luke Skywalker. And of course, Han and Leia and the droids and everything. I find it hilarious, and me and my brother laugh about this every time, because lots of like Star Wars merchandise that we have is from Marvel Comics. We have like some t-shirts. I actually have a wall poster that I actually don't have up any longer. I've got like a shirt, and it depicts the, you know, 70s Marvel Comics Star Wars comic book covers. And my brother and I are laughing constantly. We're like, is somebody going to give Luke a new outfit? Because he's wearing the Tatooine duds like forever. Like, it's a uniform. Like, it's a superhero right. costume so that he's recognizable. We're like, man, this guy's been wearing the same clothes for years.
Disgusting. Yeah. I mean, it is iconic. I love the outfit so much. I love it. I wish that he had something similar going forward, because, you know, I know a lot of people really like the black outfit that he has in Return of the Jedi. I'm personally not a fan of that one. I get what they were doing, but I wish that they had done something similar to the Tatooine and maybe made it darker.
You know what I like? You know what I like? What? I like, my favorite Luke fit of all time is the gold jacket from the medal ceremony at the end. I love the gold jacket.
Oh no, see, I thought you were about to say something totally different. I thought you were going to say I think he was wearing some kind of gold outfit in like promotional photos.
Oh yeah, no, like, no. His cool jacket during, no, the medal ceremony at the end, he gets like, for just that minute of the film, he has that awesome jacket that he wears when he's accepting his medal. That's cool. Yeah.
That probably was my second favorite outfit, and I wish it wasn't in it enough for me to say it was my favorite, but yes, yeah. If he wore that more into the other movies, like that similar outfit, I would love that, because it looks so good.
Okay, so I low-key hope, I know they're not going to make it, if they do, it'll be way off in the future, I low-key hope that if they ever make a Star Wars film that is supposed to depict young Luke Skywalker between A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back, oh man, I want that jacket to be what he wears. I want that to be his fit. Like, so bad. Yes. I know they won't. I know if they ever make a Luke Skywalker, like, new media with him, number one, it better be Sebastian Stan. Number two, I know it's going to be post Return of the Jedi stuff. Like, they're so focused on bridging the original trilogy and sequel trilogy. They're just, that's what they're going to be doing. But man, I wish it. Man, I want that.
Maybe he's got stashed away in the hut somewhere in Octo.
That'd be great. We see Finn wearing his jacket because he just steals everyone's clothes.
Yes. I love that. So this is a point that I wanted to kind of touch on that we haven't really yet. And that's one of my favorite things about the original Star Wars, you know, A New Hope, is that there are so many, I wouldn't say one-off characters, but just like there's so many small characters in the movie that kind of get introduced and then drop out, and maybe they're reintroduced again later, but like mostly there's a lot of one-off characters. And to me, I love this because...
And real, all, real quick, just for perspective, are we talking about people like Greedo, for example, that pops in and then he's gone?
Yeah, like, you know, you've got Greedo, you've got the guys that, you know, the guy in the cantina that got his arm cut off. You've got all the rebellion pilots, Bix, Wedge, not Bix, sorry, Biggs, Wedge, Bix is from Andor. So, like, you know, you've got all these just small characters, but they add so much to the world, I feel like, because if you are very self-contained with your characters and that they are the only characters in the world, they don't interact with anybody else, there's no like individual scenes with, you know, just one-off characters, the world can feel very contained. And I think that that is something that the other movies sometimes fall into that trap, whereas this feels like a fully fleshed out world with characters that have become so famous at this point, despite having literally maybe like a minute tops of screen time. Like, you know, you've got Robot Chicken, who, again, my favorite version of Star Wars, period, is Robot Chicken. like, they have entire, you know, 5-minute sketches based around these 1-minute characters. And they're just, and you see these characters also at Comic-Cons and, you know, like, for instance, from Empire Strikes Back, the guy carrying the ice cream tub running to Cloud City.
Yep.
Like, I love that the world is so big and that the fandom is so big that every single character on screen has a fan. Like, you know, it's like one of those things.
Oh, yeah. Being as somebody who has memorized the Star Wars Encyclopedia, one of the things I really enjoyed from it was that it compiled into short paragraphs biographies of like literal background characters, like especially the cantina scene. There was an entire book called Tales of the Mos Eisley Cantina that had little vignettes. It was an anthology of stories about, you know, this person's a shapeshifter, or the guy with the hookah is secretly a vampire, or like the you know, the wolf man and the weird octopus looking thing were actually a couple, or like, you know, it's great.
I love that. And I mean, that it's in every Star Wars movie, but it's especially prevalent in this one because I think it is just, it was the first. But yeah, every character has a name, every species, you know, every different design is a different species, and it has a whole backstory and planet. And it's just like, I love that because, again, it makes the world building feel so much deeper and richer than if it was just us focusing solely on Luke, Han, Obi-Wan, and Leia. Like, no, there's other people in this world, and I love exploring that, especially when it comes to the rebel pilots. You know, I love seeing Wedge and Biggs. Like, it just, again, these are, and I love that these are normal looking guys. These are not studs. They are not, you know, Harrison Ford. They're not Mark Hamill. They're just like guys that you would pick up from Home Depot and be like, yo, you want to be in a movie? Like, you know, you want to be a rebel pilot?
The rebellion is just Home Depot now.
Yes, I love it. And it again,
we need our pilots forklift certified.
Yes. And I love that they're just normal looking guys that are super charismatic despite their very limited screen time. And like I said, there are no small roles in Star Wars. If you have a line in Star Wars, you are famous. Like, that is just the facts. And you know, I think that these actors really, I don't know if they knew what they were doing, you know, when they were filming. They're just like, what is this? What is a Death Star? Like, I'm sure that they were very confused when they first were filming, but it doesn't come across because they're so laser focused in their performance and so likable and charismatic despite their small screen time. And I just love that. Like, again, it's for, as someone that loves acting and actors, like, I love seeing small time roles get the love that they deserve, and I'm always here for the underdogs in films, so I love it.
That's awesome. Speaking of actors and roles, and talk about these small roles that are actually so big that have become immortalized, I try to remember, I think that, if I don't miss my guess, and I want to check myself on this, I think that I read some behind the scenes thing that Greedo, the actor inside the Greedo costume, was actually a woman who played the role. And in order to like boost herself up to Han Solo's height for when they're like Greedo walks up and sticks his gun in his face, that she was wearing heels. So FYI, Greedo was wearing heels in the Mos Eisley Cantina.
What a queen.
This absolute queen walks up and shoves a gun in Han Solo's face.
That would have been hilarious if like they actually showed that
Just
like some alien version of high heels.
drag bounty hunters walks up and just that's
They get
great.
shot. No explanation.
Yeah, no, the Mos Eisley Cantina attracts everybody in there. Everybody, but not droids, because we don't serve their
Yeah.
kind here.
We're right there. Droidist.
And on that note, that actually is a great segue into something that I want to be sure to get into. So, one of the big major things about A New Hope, more so than any other Star Wars movie, and I think it's like we said, this is sort of hallowed ground. This is a sacred piece of cinematic history. It is the foundation upon which everything Star Wars is built. Sort of gearing up for the prequels and the release of The Phantom Menace, knowing that they'd be very CGI heavy, it would be something that Star Wars fans weren't used to from the early 80s. George Lucas decided that he was going to go back and pull out the old film reels of A New Hope and eventually the other original trilogy films, and he would revamp them with CGI. And when he did, he dubbed these CGI enhanced, color enhanced, sound enhanced, remastered versions of his films. Again, just talking about A New Hope here, the special editions. And the special editions rattled a few people's cages. When they appeared in theaters in 1997, the Star Wars fans were not ready for this. They were not ready for this at all. And there were some things people were like, okay, cool. For example, one of the things that they did was they went into the space battle, and some of the kind of clunkier, clumsier shots, or that didn't look so good from the space battle, they replaced with CGI X-Wings and TIE Fighters dogfighting over the Death Star. Well, one of the other major places that ruffles the most feathers, especially for me, are all of the special edition changes to. From the moment they enter Mos Eisley to the time they leave, because boy, oh boy, there's a lot of stuff. There is all of the totally brand new shots of them driving the land speeder through Mos Eisley. There is the collection of shots of them passing droids bickering in the streets, or Jawas losing control of the Ronto, their big mount that they're riding. There's the giant Rontos are like everywhere. One even walks directly in front of the camera, like right. We just literally see the rump of the creature walk by as the stormtroopers are walking up to them. The Mos Eisley Cantina is populated with a few new aliens that replaced ones that were there before. Fans weren't too happy about that. It was so dramatic. It gave birth to the Star Wars central mantra that for the longest time, I think, in fact, I think I should say for the longest time, it was up there with "May the Force be with you," and now is up there with under now. This is the way, and I'm one with the Force is with me, was the mantra Han shot first. Because they edited the aforementioned confrontation between Han and Greedo, where Han was supposed to be in Western gunslinger style. I mean, it's basically the same scene from, I think it's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where the guy's in the bathtub, and the bounty hunter comes for him, and he's talking to him at gunpoint. And then before he can pull the trigger, the guy in the tub shoots him because under the water, under the soap suds, he's actually holding his own gun. And he leans out of the bathtub and says, "If you're gonna shoot, shoot, don't talk." And Greedo never saw that movie, so he gets blown away. Well, George Lucas is like, Han Solo can't shoot at a guy who didn't shoot at him. That's bad guy stuff. Good guys don't shoot at people who haven't shot at them. It's not self-defense. He just murdered
Then
him.
why did you shoot it that way the first time?
Right. Like, he wimped out and made it so Greedo shot at Han first, but misses at point-blank range. And then, like, a split second later, Han pulls the trigger first. So chivalrous of him to allow his enemy, pointing a gun at his face, to shoot first, hoping that he will miss. And then, whew, now I'm morally in the right to fire back at him.
Yeah. And, like, I'm not, just because, you know, I've seen the original trilogy unaltered because my dad has a copy. But I've also seen the special edition. And for me, I don't really care much about that change, except for the fact that it looks awful. Like, just visually, you can see how jittery it looks as they literally digitally move Han's head. And it looks terrible.
As if he, like, jukes the shot by bobbing his head to the side.
Yeah, it's so jarring. It's awful. And I didn't like it. Like, I have no, again, like, I've seen both versions. I like it better that he shoots first, just because I think it's in line with his character.
Right.
I don't mind if they both shoot at the same time and he just misses. Like,
which admittedly is what they've done now. Now, to settle a controversy, they have redone it in the, when was it, 2005 Blu-ray editions that they came back and did after Revenge of the Sith. They re-edited it so that Greedo shoots at the same time as Han, but misses. Mm-hmm. And more recently, with Disney acquiring the rights to the movie, they have redone it, where there's now an additional line of Greedo's dialogue right before he shoots, what is referred to as the infamous McClunky, because that's exactly what he says.
Again, little things like that become infamous. Like, I love it. It's so stupid.
This is my general...
I was just going to say that, like, if they shoot... Yeah, I don't think that Greedo shooting first is... It doesn't look good. It doesn't work for the story. But if they shoot at the same time, that's very Western. Like, that's a showdown, which makes sense. But I do think the best version is just Han shooting first, ultimately.
Why overcomplicate it? Why overthink it? It's cool. Is that a heroic thing to do? No, it's not a heroic way. It's a cool way.
It's cool. I get that.
But so, like, of course, the one that is universally hated is the Jabba the Hutt scene.
Oh yeah, gross. Do not like. Get out.
Oh, so my hot take, mini hot take embedded in that, is I actually like the fact that they have a Jabba the Hutt scene. I think it's cool that they went back, took the scene where Han's supposed to have a confrontation with Jabba, and they went back and they're like, what if we put Jabba in there but CGI? It'd be kind of cool. This is totally my personal bias. I love Jabba the Hutt as a character. He is, like, one of my all-time favorite Star Wars characters. I feel like I'm just showing my hand for all the future favorite characters lately. But, like, I love Jabba. I loved that he was in Phantom Menace. I loved when they added him in. But I was so sad that they did my boy so dirty by making him look horrible and then redoing him in 2005 and making him look almost worse.
Wow.
Like, how hard is it to make him look just the way he... I mean, like... Someone needs to do a Jabba the Hutt face swap and show them how it's done. Just use
the
deep fake Jabba the Hutt. Can we do this? We deep fake everyone. Tarkin, Leia, Luke. What about my boy Jabba? I know it's a lot of face to swap, but we can do it. We have the technology.
I had no idea that you liked Jabba so much. That's hilarious. How did I not know that?
I think he's great. I'm literally, like, when we get to Return of the Jedi, guys, I'm going to spend a revolting amount of time talking about how cool I think Jabba the Hutt is.
You're very much like Diego Luna. That's also his favorite Star Wars character.
Really?
Yes. There's a whole interview where they ask him, like, what is your favorite Star Wars character? And he's like, you're not going to believe it, but it's Jabba the Hutt. And he's being, like, 100% serious. And he wants to, like... feel how slimy. Like, is this a fetish thing? Like, is that what this is? But you know, you do you, man.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, wait for that episode and you'll find out if it is or not.
Yeah.
But they did my boy dirty with the Mos Eisley special edition changes. I don't I think it's fine that they wanted to go in there and like revamp it. I mean, by all means, exactly what we were saying, you know, Star Wars was George Lucas, I'm limited by the technology of my time. You know, there's only so much George Lucas could do. He was limited with budget and the imagination of the rest of the crew that, you know, no one knew what a Star War was supposed to look like. You know, George Lucas was visionary, and it was very difficult for him to get people that were really on board with it too. So to come back later and bring, of all movies, A New Hope back, at least visually up to speed with the other films, I think it's warranted, even necessary. I mean, like this, I think anybody would agree with me. Even back in 83, if I said, man, I kind of wish they'd go back to New Hope and redo some of the special effects because it doesn't keep up with Empire and Jedi, I think they would agree.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, I don't think that all of the bad, or sorry, I don't think all the special effects are bad. I really like that they added the explosion rings to to Alderaan and to the Death Star. I think that makes it look much cooler. And of course, some of the polishing of the you know, the dog fighting and all that, like that looks fine. But yeah, he did way too much, especially to A New Hope. I think he restrained himself with the other movies in terms of, you know, adding special.
Well, there was less to, well, there was less to do. You
Right.
know, the special effects had already moved because Star Wars inspired gigantic leaps and bounds in movie making and in special effects development. I mean, all of them have. But like, yeah, the special edition changes were very controversial. But like, while I think he could have done a little less, or maybe we should come back and do better, I'm fully, I know this is a hot take because the Star Wars fans are really gonna come after me for this one. I really think that we could do one more pass on A New Hope. And I mean, it's needed multiple passes. I couldn't believe there were times where they were like, oh, the lightsabers don't look as vibrant. Let's up the colors. And it took them until 2005 to remember that there was a shot of Darth Vader when Luke's gonna shoot the door to close it on him after Obi-Wan's killed, where his lightsaber had no special effects. It was just a white rod in his hands. Stayed like
Oops.
that for 30 years before somebody realized it and came and fixed it.
Yikes.
Like, who was the absolute Muppet that was in charge of like noting down which shots needed to be improved? Because I'll tell you what else they could do, and this is honestly, this is my hot take, is that like we need to go back and do more to A New Hope to clean up fixes they tried to make, fix poor Jabba's face, help the man out. But number two, and possibly even more controversial than that, is you know what else needed help that they missed on?
What?
That like they completely must fell asleep by was the ending space battle. They changed a few key shots, but Lord, there are some parts, especially when Luke is like strafing the surface of the Death Star, it looks like someone's just walking over a model with a handheld camera. And like the laser bolts look bad, the explosions look bad, and like we're setting off fireworks on a miniature. Just fix it. It's just two shots. Come
That,
on,
yeah, that,
do better.
since you just mentioned
Get some
that,
help.
stop it, kiss some help. but that's actually something I noticed. Like, I think that, again, for the times, the special effects were groundbreaking and revolutionary. But there's one thing that really stood out to me for this movie, and I need to rewatch the other two to see if it's the same. But the explosions don't look right to me. Like, they don't, the color doesn't look right. The,
Oh, I know why that is. It's because when they did like the whole like, oh, it's been remastered. They literally went up and like Photoshop and like increased the vibrance. But the thing is that the explosions are weird colors in Star Wars because of the way it has to be for them to like, what am I trying to say? Like to composite them in so they don't show up with true color. They wind up being green and yellow and like weird colors. And when you crank that up, they do look strange. The colors get a little crispy.
Yeah, it, I don't know. They just like the blaster fire looks good, the fighting looks good, like obviously the miniatures and everything. It's just the one thing is the explosions. They never look right to me when I watch the movie. But again, I can't remember if they look that way in the other ones as well, but yeah, anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, it really needs it. Like, and again, and this is said out of love for the movies. Like I said, you know, I watched these movies growing up, and I always wanted them to be better. and to keep up with the where, especially after the prequels, I wanted the original trilogy to keep up visually with them, purely for the sake of cohesiveness of with the other movies. I wanted it to be as seamless a visual, you know, through them. And I know the CGI hasn't increased in, you know, dramatically between the prequels and now. I mean, you can make things look a little bit more realistic, but like they were good. And so like it leaves the original trilogy, but most of all A New Hope, lagging behind them. And I think one of the great things they've mastered with modern special effects is how to achieve something fantastic looking, but make it look seamless. And the problem with the special edition changes, whether it's 97 or 2005, it doesn't look seamless. Mm-hmm. The seams are very visible. We can spot the seams, you know? Yeah. And that's like my big thing. I wish they would go back and clean it up. Clean it up, just make it look better.
So we haven't really talked much about Vader, despite him being like kind of the main villain of the whole trilogy. So I know you wanted to say something about Vader, so tell me.
I did. Well, I mean, we were kind of on Vader overload in the last one because we were talking about Rogue One. There's going to be a lot to say about Vader in The Empire Strikes Back. But, you know, one of the things about Vader in this movie... I find it really ironic in the story, and I think this is a great Anakin-esque thing to have happen. Mm-hmm. I love that the whole reason why the bad guys lose is Vader's fault. It has nothing to do with the incredible ingenuity of our heroes who, you know, ingeniously disguise themselves as stormtroopers and boldly dive into, you know, the trash compactor to escape the prison break. And Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know, daringly luring Vader and the guards away. All of this, it's revealed, is Vader's plan. Because when the Millennium Falcon goes away... Tarkin says to Vader, "I'm taking an awful risk, Vader. This had better work." And the entire time, Vader is like, "Yep, that was my idea." Yeah, the guys, you know, chase him around, pretend to shoot at him, you know, don't, you know, capture the droids and, like, take apart the Astromech's brain to figure out where the coordinates are for the Rebel base. He's only an astromech droid that stores navigational charts. Don't capture them and do any of that. No. Let's make it cool and dramatic in classic Anakin fashion. Let's let them escape, but we'll put a tracker on their ship. That's never happened before. We'll totally do that. And then they'll lure us to the Rebel base. And then, man, imagine the looks on their faces when the Death Star shows up. And here's my favorite part. This is my headcanon. I love that they show up. And Vader and Tarkin are literally standing in the conference room. In the boardroom. And there's a call over the thing. And Tarkin's like, "Yes." And they're like... "We've arrived in the Yavin system. The Rebel base is on a moon on the far side. We're beginning to orbit the planet." And I just imagine, like, Tarkin looking, being like, "The Rebel base is on the other side of the planet." And Vader's like, "Okay, but think about it. How cool will it be when, like, they're just looking at the edge of the planet and they're just seeing us slowly coming over the top of it? Oh, man, that's going to be great." He has this flair for the dramatic. Mm-hmm. And it, are you ready for one of my worst Star Wars puns? It blows up in their face.
Oh, wow. That is bad.
The whole thing blows up, and Vader's the one who lit the fuse. Is it actually the good part of Anakin subconsciously undermining the Empire?
Nah. Just him being stupid.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
He's not smart enough for that.
No. It's great. It's great. It's further cementing in the hilarity of that thought was that after I was done watching the movie today, I popped upstairs and my brother, I told you before, like, we own a bunch of, like, nerd memorabilia, I own a lot of Star Wars books. Well, one of them is the Star Wars source book from, I think it's from, like, like it's from the early 80s for sure. And it's like, it's the Star Wars role-playing game. It's the first edition role-playing game. But the Star Wars source book contains like profiles on all of the main characters and like their stats, like how good a pilot Han is or how strong with the Force Yoda is versus versus Vader. And they have these little cool short story vignettes, like in the Jabba the Hutt and the Rancor section. There's like a short story explaining how the Rancor came to Tatooine and stuff like that. Well, in the Vader section, there is a transcript of a hologram message that Vader sends to the Emperor, and he's like, "Well, my master, I got a report that from Mos Eisley there were two droids that got on a ship, and I thought to myself, those were the droids that we were looking for. Well, they showed up here, and I knew immediately that those were them. And I knew that they couldn't have escaped without Obi-Wan Kenobi, my old master, I told you. And guess what? He showed up too. And boy, he was no match for me. I can't even describe for you how satisfying it was when my lightsaber cut through him and he just disappeared in front of my eyes. And now we're on our way to the Rebel base because I put a tracker on their ship. This day is a great day. You will see the end of the rebellion. And you know what? Grand Moff Tarkin put it great. He said their fire's gone out of the universe. Boy, he is so right. I'm going to let you know how it goes. Vader out. It's basically what it is. It's hilarious to read. It's not meant to be funny, but it's so funny.
And I love that, like, kind of building off that, that this... like directly after this movie, canonically is when, in my mind at least, Palpatine gets the call from Vader
about the robot chicken's call.
The greatest bit of Star Wars cinema ever put to screen was that 3-minute call. And like, to me, it's completely canon.
Whoa, Vader, slow down. What do you mean they blew up the Death Star? Who's they?
The exasperation in his voice and that, who's they? I love it. Oh my god. Like, I've said it before and I'll say it again. Palpatine, Robot Chicken Palpatine, is the greatest Star Wars character. Like, bar none for me.
Yeah.
Seth MacFarlane is a god for that performance. But,
so yes, good.
I do love that. And the whole, you know, as brief as it is, the whole fight on the Death Star is very impressive and very cool. You know, I do love to watch it, even though I wish, again, it was longer. You know, it's just the big finale. No need to rush, guys. But
no biggie.
We don't have budget for that.
Yeah, you know. Again, there's so many things that could go back and do. Since we're on the topic of the bad guys, I feel like this is a perfect chance for me to talk about, as we're winding down here, my favorite scene of the movie, which is, in fact, another Vader and the bad guys scene, and it is the Imperial boardroom, the meeting, that I think that the whole thing is just so masterfully done. Mm-hmm. The pacing, the dialogue, it's some of the best. And it's the one bit of true world building outside of what's going on that informs us as to the state of the larger galaxy in like a business meeting. It's exactly where it should be. It's in a business meeting of a bunch of old white guys just sitting around a table arguing. This is exactly how it should go.
The world, old white guy.
And I think it's perfect because, first of all, I love that this scene starts with the most classic struggle. There's a British guy talking about there's a real threat here. And the American guy, the only American guy at the table, Admiral Mahdi, is just there going, yeah, man, have you seen? We are literally flying a gun that's like 70 miles wide. We have built the biggest gun ever, and no one will mess with us. Mm-hmm. Yee-haw.
Literally. Yeah, it was, I gotta say, it was really jarring because I forgot about that guy that, what was his name? Admiral what?
Admiral Mahdi, M-O-T-T-I,
Mahdi. Yeah, I forgot that he was American. I, for some reason, had it in my mind that all of the Imperial people in the original trilogy were British. So I was like, whoa, American accent? What is this?
It's great. I love that he is like the highest ranking. He's like he should have like a big stars and stripes on like a big like medals all over his uniform. All he needs is like a 10-gallon hat on his head. He's like, dangerous to your Starfleet, not to this here battle station.
Don't mess with Texas.
Yes, he just got a big "Don't tread on me" on the back of his uniform.
Doug Dimmadome hat.
Yes, exactly. He's just Colonel Sanders sitting at the table. He's great. It's so perfect. But I love the way that it progresses. It starts with that argument, and then Tarkin, who Peter Cushing is amazing in this movie. He's so good.
He is. I wish that they kept him around more, honestly. Like, I wish he hadn't died in
yeah.
this movie.
Now, you know, they blew all their budget on hiring him and
Right.
Alec Guinness.
We can't afford these actors, guys.
We can't have nice things. But you know, and then he comes in, he announces that the Senate has been disbanded, which means, once again, it means so much more having witnessed the Galactic Senate in the prequels. And they talk about the rebels and what threat they pose. And then in one of the greatest employee arguments of all time in a business meeting, Admiral Mahdi just straight up belittles and just starts ranting. He just starts roasting Vader in front of everyone. He styles him a sorcerer. He talks about his devotion to that sad devotion to that ancient religion. Hasn't
Your
given you
sorcerer
clairvoyance
brains.
enough. Yep. And Vader just chokes him in front of everyone.
In one of his most famous lines, right next to "I am your father," like with the "I find your lack of faith disturbing."
And it's so good. It's so good. The whole scene is iconic from start to finish. It's my favorite scene in the entire movie. And any scene where Vader chokes someone is like automatically up in my favorite movie scenes in the
What does
movie.
that say about you, Todd? Don't think too much
I don't know.
about
Don't think about it. Anyway, what's your favorite scene?
I have two favorite scenes from the movie. I couldn't choose between them because they're actually pretty similar while being very different at the same time. And that is the entire binary sunset scene, not just the actual piece of music with him looking out over the binary sunset, but the lead up to that with him talking with Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen. As much as I rag on Luke being so whiny, I actually really do like that conversation that he has with Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen about wanting to leave, because it kind of informs his character and why he wants to, you know, go forward, go on the adventure, all that, and why he can't, you know, what's holding him back. So it's really good character building for him, I feel like, even though, again, he's just whining through most of it. But I really do like it. And I like, again, the foreshadowing with, you know, he's got too much of his father in him, that's what I'm afraid of. And just all the little hints as to what's to come in the future for his character. And then, of course, obviously, one of probably, I'd say, the most iconic shot in all of Star Wars. The Star Wars shot is him looking out over the you know, the binary sunset as the music swells. One of my favorite pieces of John Williams' music, it's probably like top five pieces, is just that 30 seconds for the binary sunset theme. And to me, that's the theme of Star Wars, not the opening credits, not the Imperial March. Like, the binary sunset theme is what I think of when I think of Star Wars music. It's so iconic and it's so beautifully shot. And again, there's no dialogue in that piece. It's just this longing look, very similar to Anakin looking out, you know, during the rumination scene, very similar to me, even from the framing, the lighting, like it's eerily similar. Obviously very different things going on there, but it can't help but feel the echoes of that. And so, yeah, beautiful scene. I love the buildup. I love the payoff with him looking out over the binary sunset. It's a beautiful piece.
And it's so beautiful because it also mirrors then, which was a great choice, the ending shot of Revenge of the Sith, because it was the looking forward in that final moment of that movie to the New Hope. And Luke Skywalker embodies the New Hope. And I like to think thematically, and once again laying groundwork for commentary in future films, you know what I'm referring to, that when they show the binary sunset and Luke Skywalker, whether he is an infant, whether he is a teenager, or whether he's an adult, that looking out over it symbolizes hope.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's one of the most iconic shots again, and they mirror it multiple times, and that just shows how iconic it is. But my second one is not as obvious, because I feel like a lot of people would pick the binary sunset as their favorite, and rightfully so. My second favorite scene is actually the destruction of Alderaan. And it's not because, not the actual act of destroying Alderaan, because again, we don't really care about it. We know nothing about it, except for that it's Leia's homeworld, and that's it. But like you said, this is such a great introduction to, well, I guess more of a reintroduction, because we already met her, but like for Leia, I think that this is a great scene for her, because we get to see her go from like this super uppity, bitchy princess who thinks she has the upper hand because she's snarky and she, you know, she can get a word in, to actually being genuinely terrified of her home planet being blown up, bargaining, reasoning, you know, pleading and begging do not do what they're going to do. And the way that she bounces off of Tarkin, like, I love Tarkin. He said, again, I wish that they had him more in the movies because he's great. But I just love their banter back and forth, you know, from her insulting him to him being completely unfazed by it and just being like, oh, how charming. Like, you're so sweet. I'm going to blow up your home now.
I love that he even pinches her cheeks.
Yeah, so condescending. I love it. But she doesn't take it. She just like pulls her face away like, bitch, please, I'm a princess, like, don't touch me. It's great. I love it. Like, it probably, I'd say Carrie Fisher's best acting in the movie, which is hilarious because she's got that fake accent going, like the fake British accent that she doesn't keep.
I like to think because she only does it in that scene, I like in canon to think she does it to mock Tarkin.
Oh yeah, no, I'm sure she does, like, even if it was like subconsciously. Like Carrie Fisher, like, I want to sound as fancy as Peter Cushing. I'm going to put on a fake accent. Yes, I love it. And, you know, Vader holding her back as she, you know, tries to stop him. And again, it's just the whole interaction between the characters and the dialogue is actually really good, I feel like. And it's a really well-paced scene. And I always love quoting Princess Leia in this scene. The whole entrance, you know, oh, Governor Tarkin, only you could be so bold. I bet recognize your foul stench the moment I was brought on board. Like, there's so many good lines from her in this scene. And I love it. And again, the only thing that could have made it better is if we actually cared about Alderaan and like the destruction, or got even an inkling of like, oh, she has a family there, or, you know, anything. But again, to me, that's not what the point of the scene is. The point is the relationship between the characters and the dynamic and the bouncing off each other. And I think that they do that very well in that scene. So that's why it's my second favorite.
And it really is a good note also to kind of go out on here to note that it really is then those veteran actors that come in. And I mean, we still see that in Star Wars. You know, for this film, it's actors like Peter Cushing, it's Alec Guinness. You know, in the prequels, it was characters like, or actors like Ian McDiarmid or Christopher Lee, where in the, you have these, you know, famous old, much older actors who, when they're there, the presence that they lend, whether it's just being around them, that kind of elevates the entire scene and then brings the best out of their fellow actors, or whether it's coaching that, you know, a way that they mentor the actors, that the younger actors they're doing the scenes with, they're just better. Yeah. You know, they're just good. I mean, in a similar way, I think that you thought that this was, you know, your favorite scene because of the exchange between a very young actress, Carrie Fisher, and, you know, a veteran actor, Peter Cushing, very much similar to Christopher Lee when he is Count Dooku having the confrontation with Obi-Wan on Geonosis. And I don't want to say Ewan McGregor was a novice actor, but certainly was still pretty early on in his career, you know, with standing there with somebody as venerable as Christopher Lee. There's just something with those scenes that adds so much more. And, you know, that happens all over cinema, but it's great seeing and highlighting those scenes in, as we said, one of the greatest movies ever made.
For sure. So what would you rank this movie overall?
Well, like we said, there's a lot of factors to involve. There's a lot of factors involved with the concluding rating. I mean, if we were rating it purely on how influential this was, how great is the contribution of 1977's Star Wars to pop culture, I mean, that can't be measured. That is immeasurable on a scale, because that is, you know, the film franchise has been immortalized, and it will be probably forever, because they'll just continue making more and more of these movies. It's a universe. It's a world unto itself, you know, like many, many other fandoms. But the movie itself, again, it factors into rewatchability and, you know, how interesting the characters are and like that. A New Hope overall is a solid 7 out of 10 for me. You know, like you said, the movie is slow in some parts. I enjoy a ponderous sort of documentary style. The characters are charming. They're timeless. The story is timeless. It's great to watch, but it doesn't have a lot of common rewatchability for me personally. Like, I wouldn't just pop this on. It wouldn't be my first Star Wars movie. So 7 out of 10 for me. What about you?
Gonna have to agree with you. That's a first.
It's a first in this podcast season. That's for sure.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I know that this is one of the most influential and iconic movies of all time. And I fully appreciate that. And I do really like the characters. I like, you know, the interactions, like I said, and some of the music and the just special effects are, you know, obviously great. But again, I think that the pacing and the editing of the movie really drags in certain points and is way too quick in others. It's just very uneven, you know, editing wise, which makes for a not so thrilling watch. So it's not one, like you said, that I would rewatch over and over again unless I was marathoning. You know, you can't deny the iconicness of these characters and this story and this world, right, that wouldn't have come about if this movie didn't happen. So you know, just for that alone, that's like several points worth of just iconicness alone. So I mean, again, it's not my favorite. It's actually probably on my lower end of Star Wars movies. Like, it's not
same for me
sequels or Rise of Skywalker bad, but it's also not, you know, up there with some of my favorites. It's kind of right in the middle, lower middle rung. So, 7 out of 10.
Yeah. Awesome. No. And I'm kind of excited now, because this is, I think, basically the halfway point of all of our watches, because we've got 5 movies behind us and 5 movies in front of us.
Wow.
So, you know, we're halfway there. So, yeah. And in a way, we're just getting started, because, hoo boy, there's a lot of stuff to talk about moving forward as we tackle the rest of the iconic original trilogy and then move on to the very controversial sequels. So you think the commentary we've had so far has been hot takes? Just wait.
Oh, yes.
Join us in the next episode, guys. Looking forward to it.
That's all for today. To all of our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode, so feel free to leave a review or comment, follow the podcast, give us a good rating, and all that good stuff.
You can find us on Instagram at Millwood and Micah Podcast, and don't forget that our sweet podcast merch is available on TeePublic. Thanks again, and we'll be back in the next episode.